welcome to the House of Comments, one of the few shows where I can guarantee there'll be no discussion of royal autobiographies. I'm Charlotte Henry and my lovely co-host is Emma Burnell. Hi Emma, how are you doing this week?
Hi Charlotte. So what have you been reading?
anything else?
Right. My God, the idea that I would even pick up a word of that.
Emma, we've promised our readers we're not talking about it.
We're not talking about it.
No, we can't do it. Instead, we've got, actually, for a sort of week in the middle of January, we've got rather a lot of things to talk about. And actually, it's, you know, the political atmosphere, Parliament is back and it's sort of ramping up a bit. And I think the big thing this week was this new piece of legislation that Grant Chapps introduced, the business secretary introduced, around strikes. Now, actually, I think there's a lot you and I are going to agree on. But the one thing I think we really disagree on is I don't think this is a fundamental attack on the right to strike, because I do think it does allow for industrial action, but just wants to limit the fallout in some key sectors. However, on the key sectors, it names a few. Some of, you know, mostly the ones you would expect. Health, there's nuclear decommissioning, travel, borders, transport services, fire and rescue, border security, decommissioning nuclear weapon installations, that kind of thing, and obviously health services. The one that's in there that I really am unconvinced needs to be in there is education. Because if the government's argument is this is about safety for the public, education is not appropriate in that argument. I mean,
transport's not about safety either.
Well, that, I think there probably
that's
is
just
an argument.
Like Pete Lynch.
There's a bit of that, but there's also, I think there probably is an argument that helping people travel around the countries, you know, properly is safe, does help safety. But education, for me, is not, and you know, travel is key infrastructure, but I don't think your teacher's being off for a couple of days is very, very annoying. Very annoying. But that isn't about safety. Now, I should make the point that at the moment,
I remember in school, my form teacher was a member of the NASUWT and they never went on bloody strikes. So we were the only ones who went to
yes.
Very annoying.
Yes, children hate it if their teacher's part of the union that never goes on strike. Absolutely. I should also make the point that the only things the government are currently consulting on are fire, ambulances, you know, health services and rail. So it's not straight in with all of this, and education may actually, you know, might not be one that ever happens. But I find it weird that that is a thing in the legislation. As a general rule, I actually sat down with a cup of tea and a lot of chocolate and went through the legislation. It's a pretty rubbish piece of legislation. It's very, very nebulous. It's all about, like, basically, if the Secretary of State and your bosses say that there's, you know, you're required to achieve this minimum service, which is never specified anywhere in the legislation, what a minimum service might look like.
Oh, no, of course they can't specify minimum service because they're not delivering it on non-strike days.
So because, the you know, minimum service is not specified, that's where I think it gets into very, very, at the moment, messy, you know, mucky water. I think that's really messy. Yeah,
this is where I pick up on your original assertion that it's not an attack on the right to strike, because if they're saying they can specify it however they want to, and you could lose your job if you don't follow that specification, then it is fundamentally an attack on people's right to strike. And that is a fundamental human right. If you cannot withdraw your labour, you are, you know, that is fundamental. You know, what is slavery if not the right to withdraw your labour?
You know, I think that's, I don't want to talk, you know, compare some people being told, members of a union being told that they need to work on a strike day while their colleagues strike to slavery. I think that's quite a dangerous comparison.
Rights.
It is. And I made that when we first discussed this, you know, end of last year. It absolutely is a right to strike. But they're not saying no one can strike. They're not banning unions from
taking
action.
No, they're saying some people can't strike, so some people don't get their fundamental human rights. And that's, you know, either something is universal or it's not.
But you don't think someone's colleagues being able to stage action on their behalf? I mean, some nurses and ambulance people did have to work and agree to work during the strike when their colleagues...
That was their decision, not imposed upon them, and that's the difference.
Yeah, no, that is a fair point. I just think I don't think it's such a big leap, because also, presumably, I think
things are never a big leap. They chip away at our rights bit by bit by bit until we don't notice anymore. And that's how you get rid of fundamental human rights. You don't do it in one fell swoop. You chip away.
I simply don't think that they're not stopping industrial action. And people within unions,
they
and
sacked one nurse for not providing fundamental, for not providing this minimum service that they don't define. That's it. That's it for me. They have completely crossed the line.
I can't agree. I don't agree, but I understand. I do understand the point you're making.
Why the fuck are you going to start sacking nurses when we've got so few and we haven't got enough of them in the first place? Oh no, you didn't do one day's work out of 365.
Well, there's a lot of things there. I mean, we all know we need more nursing staff, and all. Yes, we know that. I do think, though, the other thing I don't like about this. So I would make the case that the unions have pushed a bit too far over the last few months, and so obviously that's going to provoke a backlash from the government. Which this, like, let's be honest, this clearly is a bit. But I equally think this is not. Particularly, how can I put this?
Dare the unions do their job well.
I also don't think this is particularly diplomatic of the government if it is being genuine about trying to cool the temperature over this industrial action. I think, you know, I made the point in the last show where we discussed this at the end of the year that, in my opinion, strikes are a failure on both sides. And I think, in a way, this is further evidence of that, because clearly, and we've seen that from the action from trade unions, that this, you know, no surprise, trade unions don't like this. They're very cross about this and are going to protest and campaign against it, as is their right. I also think, I mean, do you think there is any chance that this legislation could come into force and not be challenged in the courts?
No. So it's not coming anytime soon.
No.
It's absolutely not going to deal with the current situation. If it's as nebulous as you say, which I'm sure it is, then frankly, I mean, the idea that you sit down and read legislation is not designed to be read by normal people.
Emma, it involved a lot of tea and chocolate, I've got to tell you.
You know, all legislation is designed to be written so that ordinary people can't understand it. But then that will be challengeable. This is the idea that this is anything other than a political move rather than an actual attempt to solve the current situation is just for the birds.
Yeah, I do agree with that. It's clearly highly political to, you know, placate people who are irritated, you know, members of the public who are irritated by the strikes, into placate Conservative members of Parliament who are irritated at this. Just to give you an example of how vague this legislation is, this is how it begins to talk about and to try and explain minimum service levels. It says that these work notices, which is telling people who has to go to work on a strike day, must not identify more persons than are reasonably necessary.
I mean, I don't suppose that they hire more people than is reasonably necessary.
Or have more people on ship.
Everybody.
Or have more people on ship. Exactly. Yeah, and I think that's where I did have a real problem with it. Because technically, your boss and, you know, people dealing with this could say, we need everyone to deliver the minimum service. We need everyone back.
Yeah.
And that again, I would not approve of, because I think that really is, that is genuinely chipping away at people's right to stage industrial action or stage industrial action on their colleagues' behalf. But, you know, I don't know if anyone would be so stupid to do that, but the way that is written...
How do they identify? Because I bet you anything, they'll identify the people who could maybe better afford to strike. It's really divisive. You know, they're trying to pit workers against each other, trying to break down solidarity once again.
Look, yeah, as I say, I think this is messy. I don't think it's going to... I mean, it might not even get through the House of Lords, as I understand it.
No, I mean...
Never mind a court.
But, of course, that's what Sunak wants, really. He doesn't want the legislation, he wants the fight.
Maybe. I mean... I said this to you before. I don't think particularly Steve Barclay I don't think they've been particularly effective negotiators.
No. And Grant Shapps, I mean, I'll never forget. Grant Shapps tweeted at me in 2011, judge me on how we do on house building. Well, Grant, I do.
Yes, I think I'd rather join you in that. And every other of the succession of housing ministers that have followed him.
Absolutely.
There is one other point I want to pull up here. You called me out on the last time we discussed this for maybe implying that there was a bit of a coordination going on between the unions. And you rightly pointed out that coordinated action is illegal. You know, all the unions have to conduct their own ballots. One of the education unions failed to get over yesterday, didn't they? Failed to get over the threshold. It got support, but I don't think they got over the 50% threshold of turnout threshold. Well, now we're seeing the TUC talk about coordinated days of action. I think there's, you know, from what I read in The Guardian, there's some nervousness in some parts of the union movement about it looking like a general strike and how that would play out to the public. But how is this different from what I was sort of implying in the last show?
My guess would be, I mean, I don't know, I haven't seen what the TUC said, but my guess would be that if you are looking at a strike in a school, you probably want to coordinate that between the NUT and the NUSUWT.
I think this was beyond one sector. This was multi-sector, as I understood it.
Because it's actually better for parents to have one day of strike rather than lots of separate different strikes all over the place.
Sure, but I'm talking about cross-sector.
Two kids in two different classes. I don't know, but I do know the TUC well enough, having worked there for a year, that they ain't going to be suggesting anything that's illegal. So,
yeah, and like, for example, they're conducting a campaign, no surprise, against this legislation and want a day of protest against it. Now, that is, you know, clearly within the reasonable.
Yeah, perfectly fine.
Perfectly reasonable.
That's not the same thing as a general strike.
No.
Secondary pickets, which is what's the basic coordinated action might be, let's strike on the same day. That, I think, is not illegal as such, but secondary picketing is illegal.
Mm. So, and I think this probably was talking more about striking, making sure they were striking on the same day. But, it's sort of pushing towards what I was talking about, where, you know, both sides are being hyper-political in this, aren't they? You know, the Conservative government wants to basically show that they can...
I think that where the problem with saying it's political lies is the idea that the unions are doing this to help Labour, which is what a lot of people who say it's political mean by that. And I don't think that's the case. Are they doing this to put maximum pressure on the government? Yes, absolutely. And if that's what you mean by political, I have no problem with that. The problem comes when you've got Rishi Sunak standing up at the dispatch box saying union paymasters. When he's talking about, to Keir Starmer, when he's talking about the RCN, who've never been affiliated to the Labour Party.
I actually think that this is not really helping Sir Keir Starmer and the Labour Party. It helps in one way because the public are just like, well, everything is annoying and rubbish and not getting solved under Conservative government, so let's try Labour. It helps in that sense. But equally, I'm not sure actually, you know, people associate trade unions with Labour. You know, people don't understand it to the depth and level you do. And if people are irritated by the strikes, that they might also, in a secondary way, be irritated by the Labour Party. So I'm not entirely convinced that an ongoing wave of strikes is particularly a good thing for the Labour Party.
I mean, I think there's certainly that nervousness within the Labour Party. I think it's probably unjustified, certainly at the moment. Sorry, I'm picking something up off the floor. I do apologise, which is why I'm ducking. You can't see this on the podcast, but it's very interesting. I think at the moment, public support for the strikes, particularly public service strikes, taking out maybe the rail strikes, is actually holding pretty firm. So Labour are nervous. News at 10. There's that classic analogy, isn't it, of the leadership of the Labour Party carrying a Ming vase down a highly polished corridor, and just trying to get to the other end without falling over. And I think that's what leads to this nervousness.
You can really see that when Sir Keir Starmer's giving speeches, when he's responding to issues, that there's definitely that sense.
But I think what's actually been interesting is Starmer led on the strikes and anti-strike legislation at PMQs, which I think, given that there has been this nervousness, was actually a pretty ballsy move from him. So I was quite impressed by that, actually. Not a little surprised.
I don't see he had much choice as leader of the Labour Party. But yeah, he's ducked these things before. I know what you mean.
It's his choice what he goes on PMQs on. There's plenty to criticise the government about. He didn't have to choose the thing that might have, as you said, if the government, if the public are going to associate Labour with strikes. I mean, I think if the public are going to associate Labour with strikes anyway, then make the case, which is clearly the way that they've gone. That they've gone. So good for them. But it would definitely have been something that you would normally consider Labour might have been too nervous to do, certainly maybe a year ago.
Yeah. Oh, there's definitely a slow and steady growth of confidence. There's a lot to this because, as you mentioned, there's slightly different responses sector by sector. If you look at polling, people like nurses are a bit irritated if they can't get their train, kind of thing.
Yeah. I do also think it's very interesting. The focus on trains comes for two reasons, as far as I can tell. Firstly, it's the easiest way to bash the left. The trains are seen, rightly or wrongly, in my opinion, as the spoiled sector. They already earn all this money, which isn't true because obviously it's the train workers and not just the train drivers that are striking. But also, the people who commute into London are broadcasters and columnists, and they are overrepresented. You know, most people who are affected by train strikes, there is a high concentration of that in the southeast, in the more affluent areas. And so it's not, in terms of the people who are affected, they are overrepresented amongst the columnist class. And I think I've said this before.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously quite a lot to that. The commuter class is obviously broader than that. And like the dynamic has slightly shifted, given that a lot of people can work from home. And, you know, I do think there's a little, you were talking about worker solidarity. I don't think there's much solidarity in stopping people on, you know, the laptop class can have their work, do their work from home day on a strike day, whereas there are lots of people who cannot do that. And I'm not sure there's much worker solidarity.
Again, between them. They aren't the people who are commuting. Those people get buses to work.
There's a lot of truth in that. Anyway, we don't need to repeat the arguments from the last show, but this is an ongoing problem for the government. And it's, you know, they don't seem to have found a good way to solve it. You know, we're hearing reports that they're, you know, putting pay offers on the table and things. And then this type of legislation comes in and that can't, whatever I think of the strikes, and I was pretty cross about them at the end of last year, that is not a way, you know, this is obviously, as I said to you a few minutes ago, this is inflammatory.
Yeah.
It's arguably designed to be so.
Yeah.
And that's not a particular way for it to solve this problem. I should also say,
it feels like they're managing their internal politics rather than the country.
There's a bit of that going on. There always is. I should also tell you that in this the legislation also doesn't just apply to strike ballots that would happen after this legislation is passed. If this legislation actually gets through, it would apply to any strike that is in, you know, balloted and ready to go at any point, even if it happened before the legislation was passed. It sort of is backdated, it's backwards looking as well.
I mean, that's bonkers, because the legislation, by the time the legislation passes, any strike ballot will have happened. So it's essentially, again, it's bullshit.
It's a very nebulous, messy piece of legislation. Absolutely. Talking of not slightly nonsense thing, well, actually, I don't want to diminish it, but because I'm pretty cross about it, and I think you are too. Unfortunately, we do have to talk about Andrew Bridgen, MP.
Well, hopefully the last time we ever have to talk about that.
One would hope so, yes. One would hope so. So I'm not, look, many listeners will have seen his tweet that week. They will also have seen, how can I put this? His increasing descent into conspiracism around COVID vaccines.
I read a very interesting piece on Conservative Home this morning, actually, about, it didn't really offer a solution, but it was saying, you know, cynicism is an important part of politics. But how do you stop that slide into conspiracism? And I think that's a really key question for our age, to be honest, on both left and right. Conspiracy theories aren't confined to one end of the spectrum. There are plenty left, right and centre. But yeah, he's clearly just, he's tipped. And have, you can see in his, because he was tweeting, get the jab, you know.
Yes, he's gone, he's really fallen over the line. So you're right. I mean, I should tell our listeners who may not know, I did write a book in 2019, it came out, on fake news and conspiracy theories. And one of the chapters, which would be considerably longer now if I were writing it now, was called Anti-Vax, Anti-Truth. It was about anti-vax conspiracy theories. Obviously, at the point I was writing it, there was a lot about the MMR jab and things like that. But obviously, the COVID jabs have changed this. And because it's obviously, I mean, from my perspective, we should be grateful that there was this new science, the mRNA, that allowed us to have these highly effective vaccines. There was two issues with it. One, he was spreading dangerous misinformation.
Yeah.
And he did it in a very emotive way that really could have scared people. And he might be a random backbench MP, but he still has 83,000 people on Twitter, followers on Twitter. He still has a seat in the Houses of Parliament, although he can't take it for 5 days because he's been suspended.
Yeah, this
not over this,
maybe
over
working because he's been found to be inappropriately lobbying.
Yeah, he fouled his rules. MPs have voted unanimously, I believe, that he shouldn't sit for 5 days. So he was already in a bit of trouble. And then, I mean, this invocation of the Holocaust was just so foul.
Yeah,
it was
absolutely
so foul.
I mean, there seems to be a lot of things you can get away with in terms of being a Tory backbencher and criticising your government. But it turns out accusing them of genocide is not one of them.
I mean, it was just so, so revolting. And, you know, it was too revolting. I mean, I don't need to explain why it's revolting. We all know why it was revolting. One of the, they dealt with, as soon as he sent that tweet, it took, what, I think 3 hours for the Conservatives to be like, all right, thanks very much, the chief whip. Clearly, you know, these things don't happen in a snap. There's a few people that have to make calls, but it was basically as quick as it plausibly could be, he was removed. The whip was removed from him. The problem, though, when I was researching my book, this is the thing that really, one of the things that really stuck out to me, is just going, okay, you're not, you know, this is bad, and in this case, you're not a Conservative MP, doesn't actually solve the problem of, in this case, people spreading dangerous misinformation about life-saving vaccines. Because, they don't disappear, these people.
No. And they have to be challenged. It's, the no platforming thing just doesn't work. And we've seen that. And it might have worked once upon a time when we had 5 newspapers and 3 television channels, but it's just a nonsense in the internet age. And the more that you tell people, just don't listen to it, the more people find it on their own.
Yeah.
You've got to put the counter argument out there and out there publicly. And that's why, as you know, I'm on GB News a lot. And I think it's really important to go on a platform that's considered to be, particularly right wing and put a left wing perspective, because if you're not countering those arguments, people aren't hearing the other side.
I think when people are spreading this information, you do have to, I saw, some epidemiologists putting really sensible cases forward. And that is what needs to happen. And the other problem is, of course, is if you sort of try and remove these people, you're absolutely right that, first of all, people find them anyway.
Yeah.
Of course they do. But also then they become a martyr and it adds to the conspiracy. Yeah. They're trying to silence us.
Trying to silence me. From my 83,000 Twitter followers.
It's really dangerous territory.
It is really dangerous territory. And there is an element of silencing that comes when a lot of people disagree with you all at once.
Because you're wrong.
yes, but not necessarily. For example, in a contested area. It can be the case that if you've taken a position that is not with the mainstream of your mates or your party or what have you, you can lose opportunities by doing that. And it can be very difficult, and it's a difficult choice to make. And it's very difficult to know how to deal with a case like that differently from how to deal with a case like Andrew Bridgen, who's just clearly a moron and wrong. And that's what worries me on anything like this, because I don't want people who might say, I fundamentally believe that there are better ways to address racism, sexism, homophobia than are currently the vogue, for example, to take a contentious issue. To be lumped in with people who are saying we should not address racism, sexism, homophobia, etc.
You're quite right. And we also need... I mean, you talked about cynicism. We need kind of outside the box thinking, heterodox thinking, people who are willing to challenge the ways of thinking. And this actually, when I was writing about it, I found this a real challenge, because you don't just want to say, because this is the mainstream view, you must follow it. And just because you want to say, just this is where the evidence sits now, I mean, at this moment.
There has to be a balance between we've had enough of experts, which is just nonsense because we need experts.
Correct.
But also experts need to be challengeable.
Exactly. Exactly. And it is a really fine balance to take normally. I do not think it was a difficult one in this particular case, where you're comparing something that has saved millions of lives to the millions of lives being taken.
I mean, even quite apart from anything else, this was a flagship program of his own government.
Right. I mean, we've even seen Donald Trump get annoyed at nutter Republicans, who anti-vax Republicans, where he said, get the jab, it's ours. We won. This was our achievement.
This is our achievement. Even taking out the moral, the huge moral issue with what he's doing, politically, of course he can't keep the whip. He's accusing his own government of genocide.
No, it was foul and revolting and just beyond the pale in so many different ways. The chief whip has said there will be a formal investigation. Okay, fine. He's not got the whip now. They can have an investigation. That makes sense.
There's always a process, and that's
correct.
Right. Should be
correct. I would hope / imagine, I wrote this on a blog the other day, that he does not get the whip back. And I suspect he will not be allowed to stand as a Conservative candidate in the next general election. I hope that is the case. I mean, we even saw, there was obviously a build-up in this particular case, because we saw Conservative MPs getting increasingly annoyed online every time he tweeted things like this. Michael Fabricant was getting increasingly annoyed. And frankly,
you've got Michael Fabricant on the right side. You really are out on a limb.
One of us was going to say, so it can be you. It was so appalling. Anyway, let us hope we do not have to talk about Andrew Bridgen, MP, anymore. Well, that was we've had a busy week, so there's been a lot to get through. Emma, where can people keep up with you as the politics of this year ramps up anymore?
So I'm on Twitter at EmmaBurnell_, and you can sign up to my newsletter, Hard Thinking on the Soft Left.
Wonderful. I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on Twitter, and you can get me on Substack at theedition.substack.com. If you're enjoying the show, if you're enjoying our this political odd couple of Emma and I, please, please do, listen, let's be honest, we're better looking than Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart. Share it with your friends. Please follow us in it wherever you listen to your podcasts. Share and recommend with friends. We're here. We're trying to build up our show. So do come and join us. We love having you listen to us every Friday or over the weekend.
And let us know what you think as well. Mm. And what you think we should be talking about. We
want
to do this as much as listener feedback is great. Even if you say horrid things.
Yeah. Oh, and also you can tweet at HOC podcast as well. So if you have topics you think are important and maybe we've missed, we'd love to hear from you. But until next time, we'll see you next week.